Beings do not like to record lectures of high dharma. They always rebel, so it's nothing new. I'm used to this. We're starting tonight in our quest of Taoism to try and understand the change in Taoism that happened in the Song Dynasty, which gave to Taoism the form that it has had ever since the Song Dynasty. Taoism today in Taiwan, or in Hong Kong, or in Los Angeles, is a direct descendant of Song Dynasty Taoism. And the only hitch, the only change in that 1,000 years was a reintegration or a refurbishing culturally of the Song Taoism in the Ming Dynasty. And really we'll see that what the Ming philosophers did was to relate it ever so more finely, tune it ever so more finely to the Chinese family life, so that Taoism in the 20th century comes to us. It's more of a family tradition and a family lineage now. You do not find, generally, the Taoist master who is the recluse in the mountains. There are still some, not so many. But that's been dying out continuously since the Ming Dynasty. And most of the Taoist traditions now are through the family. And this is interesting, because the general drift then throughout Chinese civilization has been to modify esoteric teachings so that they become capable of informing the everyday family scale life. The most difficult challenge that the Chinese mind faced was the introduction of Buddhism. And so that we're concerned tonight and the following week especially with the way in which the Chinese experience, the Taoist tradition, took in Buddhism and transformed Buddhism, changed it in such a way that Buddhism that we have today in the modern world is definitely a polarized religion. The Buddhism of a place like Sri Lanka and the Buddhism of a place like China are two different religions, really. And the Mahayana and the Theravada are quite distinct. In fact, the Vajrayana forms a third variety of Buddhism, and they're almost completely different. What they all share is that Buddhism has remained a monastic religion, a religion of the monks. But the Chinese Taoist tradition set out to incorporate the Buddhist experience in such a way that it could be amenable to laymen. The term for a layman in Buddhism is upasaka. The very first introduction of Buddhism into China before 100 AD was through merchants. And if you remember, in the Han Dynasty, in the first century AD, there were not very many merchants in China. The vast bulk of the population were farmers, vast bulk meaning more than 99%. The bureaucratic structure was all towards supporting the emperor, and the revenues were run by the dynastic power of the state, and they were generally developed out of an agrarian farm system whose archetypal pattern was 8 families around a central plot that contained a well. So that the merchant class of people was not really a class, but was rather what we would call today a limited segment of the population, much like financial advisors. in the total population, be a very small segment. So that the early merchants that came in were largely foreigners. And foreigners in China means that they were Indian, and they were Buddhists. It was not the Buddhist monks who brought Buddhism to China initially, but the Indian merchants. And as you can experience today, where the Indian merchants are Hindus, largely, they bring it in a very light, easy manner, not coherent at all in terms of a philosophic structure, and not even heavily identifiable as a religious structure. It's a curiosity. And somebody would ask, why do you do such and so? Or why do you have this or that? And when Buddhism first is introduced into China, around 65 AD, through seagoing merchants that come to the China coast, they come to the South China coast, which isn't a very important part of Han China at all. So it's not surprising that it isn't until about 400 AD that there's any recognition at all that Buddhism is present in China. And all that time, the Buddhist presence in China is growing in a folksy, quiet, undercover way. And it has the kind of exotic appeal that Buddhism had for Americans in the 50s and 60s. It wasn't recognized that it's a theocratic structure of monks. It's like in the United States in the 50s and 60s with Jack Kerouac and Alan Watt. Buddhism is an interesting alternative to the bureaucracies. And it's kind of fun. And the Chinese experience for the first three centuries of Buddhism was on this level. Wherever Buddhism came by ship then, it was largely a mercantile, personal religious experience that came in. When Buddhism came in as a theocratic structure, it came in via Central Asia. So into the 4th century, 390, 400 AD, marks the first really heavy incursions of Buddhism coming in through Central Asia, over the caravan routes. But these caravan routes, remember now, are a continuous economic link, unlike the rare ships, like you might have a ship a month in good time, but you might have a constant stream of caravans coming over the Silk Route. So that there was a professionalism, there was a constancy, there was a pressure, an amperage in the pipeline between India and China over the Silk Route. And the only way to keep that tremendously long, thousands of miles long, Silk Route operating was to have all of the way stations understanding that they had to cooperate together. And the only religious outlook that was cranious enough to hold all this with Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. And the development of Mahayana Buddhism in its cosmological aspect, accepting all people, whoever you are. You don't have to be a monk. You don't have to have experience in meditation. Whatever your walk of life, we've got something for you, and we've got a way to help you, to get to you. You're going to feel better, you're going to think better, and you're going to be able to cooperate with unknown tens of thousands of people, because they're all going to have the same vision. So Mahayana Buddhism, over the Silk Road, begins to develop over those hundreds of years a vision of man's capacities in an ecumenical sense, as opposed to the original Buddhist doctrine of the individual paring himself down to his own diligence. The Mahayana is exactly the opposite of that. The individual realizing the tremendous universality of all human experience, not only all of human beings, but all sentient beings. So it becomes all-inclusive and ecumenical. And so the Buddhist emperors, in this mini-dynasty period, around 400 AD, who become interested in Buddhism because it's a link between their power base and a source of revenue, like the Silk Route was. Their interest in Buddhism caused them to seek to import translators from Central Asia. They tried to get them from India, but the people in India didn't know Chinese. So they had to find some place in between India and China where there were educated people who spoke both languages, wrote in both languages, who were masterful for the Buddhist scriptures, understanding them, and also understood the Chinese way of life. And by 400 AD, there was such a great individual. His name is Kumarajiva. And Kumarajiva is one of my favorite people in world history. His mother was a princess in the royal lineage of the Kushan Empire. So Kumarajiva was born in the lap of luxury and raised in the very best family. And they were from Kucha, a rather large city on the Silk Route in Central Asia. Today it's a Gobi Desert outpost. But in those days, Kucha was quite powerful economically. They were doing the kind of business that the port of Long Beach is doing now. They were in good shape. And so Kumarajiva was invited by royal decree that he was to come and bring any crew that he wanted to. He would be given any facilities that he asked for. He would have unlimited time to do it. He would have royal patronage, and monuments would be set up for him. And so he came. These were good conditions. And he spent about 20 years in China, working, translating, setting up a whole building full of translators. And he was conscientious. He was a good craftsman as well as an artist. And he picked out a whole pattern of Mahayana sutras that would appeal to the Chinese people, leaving aside for the nuns all of the really difficult, technically demanding Buddhist meditation practices. All of those practices that would lead to the development of getting rid of the personality, getting rid of your ties to life. What Kumarajiva picked to translate were all of the glittering, wonderful Mahayana doctrines that man is a cosmic being, and he has relations everywhere in the universe, and you should get to know this population, that you will like them, and they will like you. And so after Kumarajiva, for the next 100 years, Buddhism in China becomes fabulous. It becomes a religion which affinitizes itself with the Taoist genie and the fairy tale, and the Chinese mentality loves this. These are good things, like the Sinbad stories are really Buddhist influence stories from the time of Harun al-Rashid, 9th century Babylon and Basra were very much like 5th century Chang'an. In this fabulousness, what begins to appeal to the Chinese character in Buddhism is that what is possible now is the exotic individual, that person whom the Taoist tradition loves most of all, the improbable recluse who could save the world, who could come down out of the mountains and who could unlimber his talents and save the whole show. The gunfighter of the Dharma. The guy who hangs up his spurs and who decides that he's going to be a real quiet man, Shane-like, and realizes that he can't quite do it, and he's called back, and he puts on his Dharma mind gun belt and shoots the bad guys down, and the Chinese love him, and that man was Hui Ning. Hui Ning, who is a native Chinese Buddha, who is at least on the level of Confucius and Lao Tzu, of Mencius and Chuang Tzu. And Hui Ning lives from about 638 to roughly around 713 AD. He makes the transition from the time, just at the time when Taizong is founding the Tang Dynasty. He lives all the way into the glorious apex of the Tang Dynasty. So Hui Ning lives in the golden age. He's like John Wayne with the movies. He lives exactly at the right time to be in on the beginnings of the thing and to live long enough to get into color and sound and mass distribution and big projects. And Hui Ning, true to the legend, true to the Chinese Taoist legend, is just a simple potato peeler. He's not anybody, except that he's the most brilliant mind on the planet, disguised as a potato peeler. And that the Buddhist master who is in charge of him, Hung Jin, realizes that this is the most fabulous person that he's ever met, gives him the two badges of his authority. What is that authority? It's the whole direct lineage from the Buddha passed on person to person through 27 Indian patriarchs, and the 28th Indian patriarch brought them to China, and they were passed on now to five patriarchs in China. And that in fact the legend was is that there were that the Shakyamuni Buddha was the seventh Buddha to have these implements, the begging bowl and the robe. I never received a robe, and my begging bowl has a couple of pine needles and reminiscent of Milarepa, I guess. That the begging bowl and the robe were symbols of the robe of the master. He who wears it is clothed with the imprimatur of the Dharma seal mind, and the begging bowl that he has the right to have concourse among men, to receive from them the bare sustenance of life and to return to them the basic dharma which would nourish them. That he gives the dharma to them, and their minds only understand as much as they can, but that what they can understand is that he nourishes their reality by projecting out to them the essential goodness which they have in themselves, and so completes the circuit as it is. Hung Jin gives to Hui Ning his begging bowl and his robe, and he tells him, run and hide, because everybody's going to be jealous. Nobody is going to believe that you're the man. And so Hui Ning takes off. He's young. He's a teenager. He's 17 years old. And he goes to work as a longshoreman for about 20 years. He works in the equivalent of logging camp for about 20 years. And hides the bowl and hides the robe and doesn't talk to anybody and does manual labor for 20 years. And he comes into town one day, maybe to spend his paycheck. And he sees a whole conference of Buddhist monks under a Chan master, and they're engaged in a tremendous argument. The argument is over a banner flapping in the wind, and half of them say that it's the banner that's moving, and half of them say it's the wind that's moving. And Hui Ning, after probably spitting between his teeth, says, it's neither, it's your mind that's moving. And it floored them. And they all sat down to think this out, and the Zen master included. And finally the Zen master looks up and he says, we have heard legends that Hung Jin, 20 years ago, gave the bowl and the robe to someone who has been lost to us. Are you that one? And Hui Ning, true to the Chinese code of excellence, doesn't affirm it, but he doesn't deny it. He says, oh, but I am not worthy. Meaning, yes, I am he. And they all, including the Zen master, say, you're the one who should have the high seat in the lecture hall. All we know are the books. And we don't even know how to interpret these books. Where you have the original Dharma mind that the Buddha had. Not only that the Buddha had, but that all the Buddhas have had. You have that mind. You're the living amperage of the cosmic Buddhas right here in our presence. All we can do is argue. And so at the age of 37, Hui Ning is installed for the first time in his life in the, I think it's the monastery there at Pao Hing. I believe that's the name of it. Let's check our facts here. This is The Golden Age of Zen by John C.H. Wu. Ying Sung is the man, and he's the Paolin Monastery. And so he is established there in 677 A.D., and he taught there for 36 years until his death in 713. In Hui Ning, he brings to the Chinese Buddhist tradition, to the Buddhist tradition, to the Chinese Buddhist tradition, to both of them flowing together now, he brings them into the Taoist tradition. And the point at which the Taoist tradition is entered into there with Hui Ning is that he brings two great streams together like fire and iron. He brings the Maha Prajnaparamita Sutra, the large sutra on the perfection of wisdom, which is the largest of all the wisdom teachings in Mahayana Buddhism. He brings that together with Chuangzi. And Hui Ning, by bringing these two together, braiding them together so that they flow as a single spinal column from here on in Chinese history, makes Buddhism in China a Taoist recreation at the time of the 670s, 680s, 690s, into the early 8th century. It will not always stay that way. There will come times when the traditions are forced apart or torn apart, but they're forced apart and torn apart in the minds of some individuals. But there will always, after that, be a lineage in China where Buddhism and Taoism are the same mind. Not only Buddhism and Taoism, but Confucianism, Buddhism and Taoism, will be the same mind. And there will ever after be individuals who exemplify that mind. I'm being specific now and not saying mentality, because it isn't a mentality, but it's a mind. And there are individuals who I have met who have that mind. It is extant into the late 20th century. In Chuangzi, the easiest place for us is in chapter 16, which in this translation from Burton Watson, published by Columbia University Press, is called Mending the Inborn Nature. Mending the Inborn Nature. Here's the translation of the first paragraph. Those who set about mending the inborn nature through vulgar learning, hoping thereby to return once more to the beginning, those who who set about muddling their desires through vulgar ways of thought, hoping thereby to attain clarity. They may be called the blind and the benighted people. There's no way, by learning, that you can return to the beginning. It's even when stated in that way, a logical impossibility. There's no way by building on learning that you can get back to the roots of the mind, the original mind, before there was learning. There's no way to do that. There's no way to have a sense of self-trueness by experiencing the interpretation of desires through thought. Because one then has the interpretations as well as the desires. So Chuangzi then says, the men of ancient times who practiced Tao, the way, Tao, employed tranquility to cultivate knowledge. That is, the knowing that they were after was not a knowing of learning. It was not an episteme, but was a gnosis, and needed to be cultivated in the sense that one had to prepare oneself to have it happen. Or, if I can use the Greek sense which Plotinus uses here, one had to prepare oneself for an epiclesis, for it to be delivered to you. Or to be even more specific, not so much to be delivered to you, but to be evoked from you. If you were prepared in the right way, the right teacher could come and in the right way could evoke exactly what was needed. And the laying in of that was the epiclesis. And that's what happens in Hui Neng. Hui Neng is very much like Plotinus in the sense that he could do it. That he could prepare, or not so much prepare people, but he could see where they were, like an excellent physician, like an old country doctor, who knows the people in his district for generations, and he knows that the Jones boy is the son of so-and-so, and the grandson of so-and-so, and the cousin of so-and-so, and he has this kind of condition, and if you give him rhubarb pie, he's going to get over his flu. Whereas if you gave it to the Smith girl, it wouldn't work. Huineck had that kind of country doctor exquisiteness of being able to see people for what they were. And the incredible universal class genius to be able to know exactly how to bring out what they needed to get that spark. In classical Buddhism, it's called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta, the thought of enlightenment. That once the spark is lit, the thought that you can be enlightened, once you really believe that, once that seed is born in you, that it is inevitable that it will grow. But that seed has to be planted, otherwise there's nothing to grow. That all of the convolutions that you go through, of learning, of practice, and so forth, are dry heaves. There's nothing there. There's nothing to work with. But once the seed is there, no matter what you do, even in the ordinary life, it's working on that growth. That the thought of enlightenment, the bodhicitta, is the seed that needs to be evoked from someone before they can even begin. Then, whatever they do, they grow. Then the first class growth is in terms of letting them unfold naturally as a man or as a woman, as a Chinese, as an Indian, whatever the real situation is, that they unfold in terms of that reality. The everydayness is important then, because the everydayness then becomes the mysterious excellence. It becomes, in fact, what is known in Mahayana as the Dharmakaya, the body of truth. That the everyday experiences that you had before were mundane and prosaic, but once the bodhicitta is laid, once that seed is there, that everydayness is exactly the right growth environment. Because as that individual grows naturally, naturally in terms of being a man or a woman, naturally in terms of being a Chinese or a Korean or an Indian or a Persian, that natural growth will have the seed of enlightenment grow in just that way. And that there will come a phase or a stage of fullness then, where the seed of enlightenment is founded well enough in that person, in that individual, in that growth, that some sudden crack in the shell of ordinariness will reveal the extraordinary enlightenment that is there, the Dharma that is there in that person. But that until that happens, they should just be like every day as much as possible. Two things are necessary then, like a parenthesis. One is to start the seed of enlightenment growing, and the other is to nourish it to the point through everydayness to where it is full, and then to break that shell. Then the purpose runs exactly radically opposite, to be every day up to a certain point and then to be exotically radical all of a sudden, as much as possible. So that Hui Neng transforms Buddhism into Chinese Taoism. The Buddhists don't like to hear this, the Taoists don't like to hear this, so Americans like me talk this way, because I don't mind offending both. But along with mending the inborn nature then, the men of ancient times who practiced the way employed tranquility to cultivate knowledge. Knowledge lived in them, yet they did nothing for its sake. So they may be said to have employed knowledge to cultivate tranquility. Knowledge and tranquility took turns cultivating each other, and harmony and order emerged from the inborn nature. Along with Chuangzu comes the Maha Prajna Paramita Sutra, the large-scale wisdom literature. And I'm going to pick out just two paragraphs in this from the very beginning of this sutra. One, poignantly enough, concerns the acceptance of cognition of Dharma in origination. And here's how it reads in translation. This is published by the University of California Press and came out in 1975. One of Edward Conze's last works. It took him a whole lifetime to be able to translate this. This is the first time that this has been translated into any language other than from the Sanskrit to the Chinese since 1,000 years. Maybe 1,500 years. It was extraordinary that we have this. In terms of the synchronicity and patterns of world history, it's like times of Kumarajiva for us. Here's how the translation reads. It's very esoteric and yet ordinary. For that bodhisattva who courses in perfect wisdom penetrates to the dharmic mark of dharmas, which is neither defiled nor purified. It is thus that a bodhisattva who courses in perfect wisdom should learn to recognize the concept of dharma as a word and a conventional term. He will then never settle down in a form or any of the other skandhas. Not in any of the perfections, not in their name or their mark, not in the body of a bodhisattva, nor in any of the five eyes, or the super knowledges, or the 18 kinds of emptiness, not in suchness, not in the reality limit, not in the element of Dharma, not in the maturing of beings, the purification of the Buddha field, or skill and means, and why. This is classic style of Prajnaparamita literature. They lay out the whole banquet, every conceivable variation. And it's none of that. And why? Why is that so? How can you say that? And why? Because he who would settle down, or whereby or wherein he could settle down, all these dharmas do not exist. None of this exists. None of it. But it all has to be talked about precisely with discrimination, with accuracy, because it's all a part of the maturing of the shell. All of it. And that as the everydayness matures in a person, there are persons of great capacity and great mentality who have to have this kind of, quote, everydayness fed to them, and it has to be matured, and it has to be kept on to an indefinitely cosmic level, so that they never can quite figure it out, but they always keep trying, up to a certain point. And then the other part of the parenthesis has to be brought in. Then that whole structure has to be challenged radically, effectively, immediately, and pierced through, so that they don't just give it up, so that the whole thing is ruined, so that it is smashed, so that it's not workable anymore. It's junk. You've not only ruined their day, you've ruined every possibility of them ever understanding anything. You've ruined the whole cosmos for me. And the Huineng, Chinese, Taoist, Chan Buddhist master would say, that's right. I sure as hell have. Now you're free. Now you don't ever have to be in any box, because the best box of all has just been ruined, and there's no other box anywhere near that box that you're going to climb in. Now you don't have any box to be in. Now the person says, well, what am I going to do? And the master says, well, what are you doing? You're complaining. At least it's a start. That's the tradition of Huineng. And Huineng, then, true to that quality of insight, destroys the whole patriarchal tradition. He says there are no more patriarchs. He says the bowl will not go to anyone, the robe will not go into anyone. There is no more tradition. That is to say, there's no more tradition in the sense that that was a form. It was an identifiable form. It was the most powerful form in Chinese Buddhist experience. In fact, the form that it was in, if I can find it, was called the 40 Gatha form. I don't know if I can find it off the cuff or not. The 40 Gatha, probably can't find it. No, I think I can't. Anyway, the classic form was that the seven Buddhas, the six prehistoric Buddhas and the Shakyamuni Buddhas, the 27 patriarchs that were there in India, and the 28th patriarch being the first patriarch in China, and then the five patriarchs in China, added up to 40 stages. 40 is the classic universal number of purity, 40 days in the wilderness, 40 years of maturity. It's a classic form of purity. That this 40-part step lineage had reached the completeness of the form, and had Huineng passed it on to a 41st person, it would have been a lie. That the only way that that kind of a circle can be kept in integrity is to keep one part of it open. So if the 40th person, Huineng, had to destroy the ongoingness of the tradition so as to make, by retrospection, by retroaction, to make all of that tradition true, that all those Buddhas did exist, and all those patriarchs did exist, and they did pass on the lineage to Huineng, who then had the authority and the power to stop it, to say there's no more lineage after me. But what there is instead of there being a personal one-on-one lineage, while that's no longer possible, now it's radiated out, it's broadcast out. It's in the mountains, it's in the trees, it's in the land, it's for anybody, it's up for grabs. Anybody can have it. You don't have to queue up to me or to any other patriarch, he says, ever again. And the same thing happens, because the Taoist tradition makes it happen, the same thing happens to the Buddhist lineages in the early Tang Dynasty as happened to Taoism when the Han Dynasty fell. After the Han Dynasty fell, there were thousands of schools of Taoism, hundreds of lineages. And complementing to that, with the rise of the Tang, Buddhism also then becomes multi-lineage. The Japanese, who love to codify things, say, well, there were five schools. But there were many schools. There were as many schools as there were individuals after Hui Ning. But in this range, in the spectrum of the many schools, there was still that impossible possible single lineage that understood what Hui Ning had done and did that same thing. And this Chan lineage, which comes down to be Rinzai, the Rinzai sect of Zen Buddhism in Japan, which was the sect that came to the United States through D.T. Suzuki. The Rinzai sect takes for its understanding that there was no personal passing on. They put a name in the charts, but it's inconsequential. But the person who picked it up didn't pick it up from Hui Ning personally, but picked it up from his insight into reality. And his name was Ma Tzu Dao Yi.